Judiciary is called to order at about 2:12, and it's April the 23rd. Present from the record, for the record, we have Representatives Guerra, Samuels, Ogg, and myself. We do have a quorum to conduct business. We have today four items on the agenda. We're going to start with Senate Bill 309, Blood Pathogens Testing of Prisoners, by Senator Wagner. Then we'll go to the confirmation hearing for the Board of Governors of the Alaska Bar, Mr. Joseph Folhaber. Then House Bill 551, Drug Felony Disqualifying Teacher, by the House Judiciary Committee. And then House Bill 545, State Lease and Contract Extension, by the House Rules Committee. And I intend to get to everything on the agenda today. So without further ado, Senator Wagner.
Madam Chairman, I'll have about my staff.
Fantastic. Right.
For the record, my name is Kurt Olson, staff to Senator Tom Wagner. Before you today is Senate Bill 309, a bill dealing with the testing of prisoners for bloodborne pathogens. Currently, Alaska allows for the testing of prisoners for bloodborne pathogens at the request of rape victims only. This bill would allow correctional officers who have been exposed to blood or other bodily fluids to request testing of the prisoner responsible for the exposure. Alaska Statute 1815 would be amended to include five new sections. AS 1815-400 authorizes the process of testing. AS 1815-410 provides the consent provisions. AS 1815-420 addresses testing without consent. AS 1815-440 addresses confidentiality issues and provides penalties for disclosure. Last section is AS 1815-450, which defines the terms in the section. Last year, 41 correctional officers were potentially exposed to bloodborne pathogens. In most of these cases, the exposure was intentional and one of the few weapons readily available to inmates. Senator Wagner first became aware of the problem last fall when we were contacted by a correctional officer from Wildwood who brought this problem to his attention. That particular correctional officer, I believe, had been bitten. The prisoner had told him that he was sick, but that he wasn't going to tell him what he was currently suffering from. The gentleman in question had, I believe, 2.5 weeks of treatment. In a situation like this, they treat him with a number of medications all at the same time because they don't really know what they're going after, so they end up pretty well knocked off their feet. This particular gentleman, I believe, didn't work for 2 weeks. The cost of the drugs were approximately $3,000. He's back at work and is showing no symptoms at this point in time, but he had some serious problems with his home life and his family during this period and still has the uncertainty of not really knowing whether or not he may still have some potential exposure. We have 2-0 fiscal notes, one from corrections and one from the Division of Risk Management. The risk management fiscal note indicates that there will be a savings to the state, but because they don't really know the frequency or the severity on a year-to-year basis, they can't really quantify it. But they do believe that there will be some savings. This would bring us in line with about half the states and the federal government, both of which both the federal government and I believe 24 other states have provisions similar to this. It's supported by the Department of Corrections. I believe Deputy Commissioner Portia Parker should be here shortly to answer any possible questions. And I thank you for your consideration.
Thank you very much. Questions? Representative Samuels.
Thank you. More a comment, Madam Chair. The prisons that I've toured last year, we toured Lemon Creek and then we toured the facility in Arizona. And it was true that that is one of the problems that they have. It's one of the few things that the inmates can do to get back at the guards that you can't do anything about. They can cut themselves, cut you. They can do those types of things that you don't have a lot of control over. So I think this is a pretty good protection. I don't think it'll stop the problem, but it certainly mitigates the results a little bit. So.
Other questions, Representative Guerra?
So
a matter of policy, I have no problem with this. I'm just, there's a constitutional, a couple constitutional questions I'm wondering about. Do we know if the state is trying to prove a criminal case, are they allowed to take somebody's blood without the person's consent?
Through the chair, to the best of my knowledge, they can only do that at the request of rape victims at this point in time in Alaska.
That's correctional officers, right?
Yeah.
I'm talking about in a criminal case, just apart from that. I'm just wondering, I think there are limitations on taking somebody's blood without their consent to prove that they were involved in a murder, let's say, or whether or not they were. And I guess I would want to know what those restrictions are so that I can understand the part here that allows the correctional officer to take blood without a person's consent, just to make sure that it satisfies the same constitutional side. I don't know.
Excuse me, I'm informed by Ms. Parker here that not without a court order, and that's what our bill does too. It requires court order.
Okay. That's the testing without consent part. And then what's the showing that the correctional officer has to make in order to get the court order? It seems.
Portia, you want to come up?
I'm sorry. I'm reading through this now. I think yeah. It seems actually so. There's a showing that the essentially a physician has to say that they need the information.
Want to comment, Ms. Parker?
Yes, for the record, Portia Parker with the Department of Corrections. I believe that there is an exemption actually in this bill that does not allow any blood collected through this process to be used in a criminal proceeding against the defendant at all. That has to be a completely separate process. This is only for the health and safety of the correctional officer.
Representative Vaughn?
Early in the bill?
Yeah, it's right. It starts on page bottom of page 2, and then it goes on. It goes on to page 3.
The clarity of the language that you were talking about, I was wondering where that was. The federal one says. Madam Chair, on the very back, the federal one, just one simple sentence. It says the results of a test under this section are inadmissible against the person tested in any federal or state civil or criminal case proceeding. Now, I was just wondering.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Very straightforward, simple language like that. I was having trouble finding that in here.
So it's on page 5, is that starting on line 4? Is that meant to be confidentiality, penalties, or bloodborne pathogens, test results of a prisoner are confidential and may not be disclosed except as provided in 18. Let me look that up, what that is. 18, 15. 400.
I believe that's what the remainder of the bill is.
Yeah, that's right. So just as it is, except as authorized here. So is there, Ms. Parker, or the sponsor, is there, can you lead us to the place that makes it clear that the test results can't be used in a prosecution? Representative Garrett, did you find it?
I found, but I don't think this is a, there's a notice that has to be given to the prisoner, but that's just a notice on page 2, line 12. That still doesn't tell me where the requirement is.
Okay, well, I think what it does, I think on page 5, starting on line 4, so it's section 18, 15440 with respect to confidentiality and penalties for unauthorized disclosure. What it's saying is that bloodborne pathogen test results of a prisoner are confidential. So that's the outset. that can't be disclosed. So that would be for anything. That would be for a prosecution. That would be for anything else, DNA testing, whatever, except as provided in 1850-400 through this, which is this bill. So, I mean, I think that's where it's saying it. I think it's saying that, you know, you can't do it except for the purpose of testing to find out. Ms. Parker?
I do believe that the protection is on page 2. It says that the information, prisoner's name or other uniquely identifying information, shall be reported to the correctional officer if requested, and that the test results collected are for medical purposes and may not be used as evidence in any criminal proceedings or civil proceedings. And that was our intent, was that we don't want them to be able to be used, because we would like to have them tested for a completely different purpose if it's going to be used in a criminal or civil proceeding other than for medical purposes.
That's right. And then so that works together with the section I was talking about on page 5 and makes it clear that, again, that the test results are confidential, can't be disclosed, and if they are, a prisoner may bring a civil action against a person who releases the prisoner's name or uniquely identifying information with the test results, or otherwise releases the test results. So the two kind of work together. Representative Gruenberg.
Sorry, I apologize for being late. I had some constituents who just walked in at the last minute.
We understand.
I have some questions, and Kurt and I have talked, and Portia and I have talked too. I'll go back to the one that we had talked about, and we talked about in state affairs, and unfortunately I wasn't there when the bill passed out, so I'm going to continue our conversation here. I am concerned that that there's nothing in here specifically of protecting third innocent parties who are infected, so that they can get the information and then their doctors can treat them. Like, let's say somebody is bitten, guard is bitten, and then has sex with their wife. I want the wife to have, or her physician, to have access so that they can find out whether they've got to treat her for HIV or something like that. What can we do about that?
Madam Chairman, Representative Gruenberg, we have to follow both HIPAA and OSHA in how we disclose information, particularly any kind of medical information. And when I spoke with our medical director about that, he said that that hasn't been a problem, but that we would have to follow what we are allowed to release in medical information.
Which is, tell me what it is and how we can put that in the bill to protect it.
I don't know exactly what all the rules are for HIPAA. And
I would like something that absolutely protects to the maximum extent that we can do it under HIPAA. This is the same question I asked in the other committee, and I really would like to get an answer and hear that in this bill.
What I can do is have our medical director online. I did arrange that for the last committee hearing, and it didn't get to the question, but we can certainly arrange to either have him online or have him provide a written response to the committee.
Yeah, I'd like to, because there's nothing in here that allows the third party or their physician or PA or nurses, advanced nurse, but whoever their health care provider, to get that information, and I'd like something in there that gives them that right. May I continue?
Yes, Representative Gruenberg.
So that's the first, that's the most important thing. Secondly, the Health and Social Services did a bill analysis, and I don't see, and this is something I hadn't looked at until last night, but this was done by Doug Bruce, the director, and it was addressed, it was mentioned to you. Have you seen this two-page document?
Yes, I have.
It didn't look like. Do we have the copies of that in the packet, Madam Chair? I think it may have, because I saw a bunch of copies.
Yeah. But,
if I can go through this. On page 2, line 12 was the first one, and this is on the second page of this. There are like 5 specific amendments they asked for.
Oh, okay, we don't have it.
I've never seen it before, but I can
copy
it.
Okay, this is, if maybe can we do something or come back to this, because then you can follow why doesn't make sense.
Okay, we'll come back to that. In the meantime, Representative Guerra.
Yeah, I've got only one concern jumps out at me. There's a, and I don't know if there's a gap in the language. If you look at page 2, this thing about using the evidence in criminal proceedings, and I'm going to say as a matter of policy, I don't have a strong opinion one way or the other right now as I sit here, but if you look at page 2, it says you can't use it as evidence in a criminal proceeding, but certainly if you can imagine a circumstance where the investigators are wondering, you know, whether maybe one of whether somebody in custody did something, and you can imagine a case where they took the blood, they didn't actually use it in the criminal proceeding, but they shared the information off the cuff with the investigators. Could you do that? I mean, it says you can't send the test to the prosecution and say here it is, but could you informally whisper to them and say, hey, this is what the blood test says, even if you can't use it as evidence in court? Is that okay? I don't know if that's a, I don't know if that's a real constitutional concern or not.
Through the chair, I believe that's addressed in line 26, 27, 28, 29.
Say it again.
Page 2, through the chair, I'm sorry.
Okay.
I believe it's addressed in line 26 through line 29.
Madam Chair.
Where it can only be released to the correctional officer.
On this point.
And then without any identifying features.
Representative Groenberg?
If the members would look at the letter that's being distributed from the Department, I think it's from the Department of Health and Social Services, this appears on page 2 of that, but I had listed it as my number 1. I sort of went in order here. Thank you. If the members would look on page 2, the very top thing, page 2, line 12, indicates the test results may not be used as evidence in any criminal proceedings or civil proceedings. And that's in quotes. In some cases, it could be appropriate to charge a prisoner in an institution who has intentionally attempted to infect a staff member. Test results would be necessary evidence. And, Madam Chair, I can see them being used in evidence in a civil suit or used in evidence in a criminal trial for an assault or something like that. And I was prepared to discuss making an amendment that would delete on lines 12 and 13 of page 2 everything after medical purposes. It seems to me that if somebody bites somebody else and they have to take a blood test as a result of that, that, you know, they can hardly complain if that evidence comes in and is used in a legitimate judicial or administrative proceeding.
Here we go.
I was going to move to strike that language, and somebody gave a good reason why.
Strike what language?
Okay, the language, Representative Garris, is on page 2, lines 12 to 13, striking everything after medical purposes. In other words, striking the phrase, and may not be used as evidence in any criminal proceedings or civil proceedings. I think that's not good policy, and we should allow that to be used. And maybe I could ask the panel if there's a reason why we shouldn't do that.
Madam Chairman, the reason that we actually prefer it to be this way is we think that there will be more problems with the blood test that we have done by the Department of Corrections, where we have requested, or the correctional officer has asked, that the sample be taken for medical purposes. We would rather have it done again by their own doctor and to have it done so there's a chain of evidence with that if it's going to be used in a court proceeding.
Oh, you're just, through the chair, you're just talking about the one that you've done, but not a prohibition against them doing their own.
Certainly not, no. We don't have any opposition to the collection of the blood. What we're concerned about is
what yours is
that
used
we
for.
Collected it. It may be stored. There will be questions about whether it is a valid sample. And we would prefer that if it's going to be used in a court proceeding, that the blood be drawn independently of us.
I don't have a problem with that. I didn't understand. May I go through the
Representative Groenberg, can you further?
My other things relate to.
You can go ahead and deal with your questions.
I'm sorry.
All right, you can finish, and then we'll get back to Representative Garris' concerns.
Now, the next thing that I had. And please, you'll realize I don't have a number two, and that's because I had number two under the third party problem that we talked about a minute ago. Number three is the next. Page 2, line 25, indicates that the facility must first attempt to get existing test results under this subsection before taking any steps to obtain a blood sample or test. Seems unnecessary, as previous test results are most likely irrelevant. The current test results are what is needed, and even current test results could be irrelevant, given the person could still be affected and it wouldn't show it right away. Time frame. I was thinking of, that seemed to me to be a well-taken point also, and eliminating the sentence on page 2, lines 24 to 26, the sentence, the department must first attempt to get existing test results under this subsection before taking any steps to obtain a blood sample or to test for bloodborne pathogens, in view of what Health and Social Services said.
Through the chair, would it be helpful if we got the medical director online right now to clear up some of these points or address them at least?
Fine with me.
Senator Garrett?
I didn't think it was really needed.
Senator Samuels?
I would jump from Gruenberg. If you get the existing test results, if they're a month old, they're irrelevant. So they'd almost have to be existing test results in a short time frame. So I would hate for the department to waste time having to do a search, which they're not going to use even if they find test results.
Let's roll this bill down to the bottom of the calendar and await the medical personnel. If they can come online, that would be great. And we'll get the bill out, but we need that information. So we'll set it aside.
Madam Chair, just so people know, I also intend to mention the other things I've circled here as labeled number 4 and number 5.
You guys have a copy of that, sponsor? Okay.
And I'm not trying to rag this around. I didn't see this until last night. The department seemed to have legitimate concerns. And Senator, I just want you to know.
Okay. Representative Garrett?
And just as you think about this, though, your first concern, I don't think, is one we need to address, the HIPAA thing, which the idea of the third innocent person, because if a prisoner bites a prison guard, the prison guard then infects a third person, the prison guard can still ask for the test. So they can then share that information with the third person. I don't know that we need to go the next step and investigate how to deal with the third person thing.
May I respond, Madam Chair?
Representative Gruenberg?
The thing I'm concerned about is a situation where there's a bite, and then there's sex with a third person, and then they have a fight. And for some reason, the guard won't reveal. Now, this could be a life and death situation. It won't happen very often, but it could be very important.
Okay. Well, we're really getting out there in our hypotheticals today. Could happen. Yeah, it's true. Okay, so if you guys could just look that over, I would like to get this bill out for Senator Wagner today. So if you guys can get to those questions and then let Vanessa, no, and we'll bring it back up, okay? So we're going to set...
Madam Chair, it would be a good time to have the...
I'll stop what we're doing and set whatever I'm working on aside as soon as they're on the line. Yeah, okay? Okay, so with that, Senate Bill 309 is set to the side. Let's go ahead and take up our confirmation hearing for Joseph Fallhaber for the Board of Governors, Alaska Bar. He is on the line. Are you with us, Joe?
Afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. Tell us why on earth you would want this position.
Well, it's about my seventh year, maybe starting my eighth position. And I initially started it with a cause, and I had a years ago, Senators Bunkley and Frank going to submit a bill that would convert our Civil Rule 11 in Alaska foolish rule at my behest. That was because I got hit with a totally frivolous lawsuit, and I thought I would do something about it. That didn't go anywhere. Then Governor Hickel agreed to do the same thing, and as we can remember, he didn't really end up with a lot of power the way he got into office. And at any rate, I guess I sort of became converted and infatuated with the legal process. And it is, although not, I think it's the best one in written history. So I've enjoyed it, and I like to think I've contributed something. And I think that the Board of Governors, our association, and I would say especially the staff, actually are just some of the finest people I've ever met, and I've enjoyed working with them.
Fantastic. Okay, questions for Mr. Fallhaber?
Yeah, I guess I do.
Representative Gruenberg.
Mr. Fallhaber, this is Max Gruenberg. We a lot of times in the bar hear from bar about bar activities from the point of view of our lawyer representatives on the Board of Governors. It's not often we hear from non-lawyer representatives on the Board of Governors. And I'd be interested if you have any comments or thoughts about the Board of Governors. And I have one particular interest, and that is whether you feel that we should have mandatory continuing legal education.
Funny you should ask that. Several years ago, as you know, I'm trying to think of who our gang of four was. It was myself, Ray Brown, Will Shindo, and probably a couple of others. I think David Bundy was involved. Kind of led a charge. Give me one away.
I'm sorry, you're cutting out a little bit.
Anyway, I may alienate you with this admission, but I was instrumental in getting the move for continuing legal education passed by the board. And if you remember, I ended up debating Judge Kleinfeld in the Fairbanks convention, if you were there.
I was. I strongly support continuing legal education. I remember Andy. I think I probably would recall you. I was right there in that room.
Okay, and it was. I was very. It was my best day of my life because, well, I won't, that's an overdramatization, but I was very happy. Andy Kleinfeld is probably twice as smart as I am, and four or five times as educated, and I clearly won that debate. And I think basically that I believe that the public expects lawyers to have continuing education, and if you're going to have occupational licensing, I think that the purchasers of those services have a right to demand a given level of expertise. It isn't people like Judge Kleinfeld that need to continue in education. It's the ones that don't get it and the ones that we see in discipline all the time. So, as you know, the Supreme Court changed our mandatory program to a voluntary mandatory program, whatever that is.
Yeah, I'm aware through the chair. And I hope you continue to do that. That's a very good public policy you're taking, and for exactly the reasons that you're taking it. And I want you to know that there are many, many lawyers in this state. I don't know if whether it's a majority or not, but many who really strongly support what you're doing.
Thank you. That's good to hear. If I could add one thing that's relevant in this next week's convention. As you know, we've asked for a raise in bar dues. And I guess if there's anything that a public member can bring to the table, it's sort of a sense of business. And we've had only two public members at the last few meetings where we addressed this issue of bar dues. And I guess I was a little bit surprised and frustrated that, to me, it seems to be a pretty simple thing. The cost of the bar can be paid for by yesterday's lawyers, today's lawyers, or tomorrow's lawyers. Now, we inherited an aggressive due structure that was meant to build a fund and then kind of use it until it diminishes as a cost increase due to inflation. Well, I would make the argument that in a mandatory bar, the Board of Governors should, first of all, determine that all the services are necessary and that we're meeting our mission statement and that we're doing it fiscally, in a fiscally responsible manner. Second, you take what it costs and you divide it by the number of members and you have a break-even budget every year. And then I guess the third point that I would make is it's not the end of the world that we do have some money in the bank, because if you've got less than 1 year's cost in the bank, I don't think that means that you're too fat. But anyway, that's kind of my little soapbox on the dues.
For the record, I agree with you, sir.
Thank you.
Representative Guerra?
Thank you, Mr. Fall Labor. This is Representative Les Guerra. You know, I don't pay bar dues anymore because I've gone inactive. I don't practice anymore. But, I mean, aren't the bar dues in the state already, aren't they the highest in the country?
You know, I really don't see that as relevant because, first of all, it's apples and oranges. You've got mandatory bars and non-mandatory bars. You're working in a town that has probably 15,000 degree days for an environment. And, I think if you're, not that you shouldn't compare yourself to other bars for purposes of learning how you can do things better, but if you start out with essentially a zero-based budget every year and you're going to accomplish your mission statement, you know, what it costs is what it costs.
Representative Kira.
Thanks. I guess here's my concern. I don't have an answer to this. I've got to assume from dealing with the bar that the real important things they do are enforcement, investigating complaints against attorneys. Those things have to be done. The bar has a very good program where they try and deal with people who have complaints about excessive lawyer's fees, and that has to be done. But I would really want to hear that somebody would take a look and see whether the bar is operating efficiently and whether or not it's those fees are necessary, because I do think it's relevant that they are so high. Just your comments on that.
Yeah, I would say that you if you were privy to the process that we had in the budget this year, you would be sure that we're diligent. I would also say it's almost brutal. I mean, and we examined virtually everything with probate budget, and there was quite a bit of controversy. Our staff is probably, I just can't say enough good about them. I've served on a number of nonprofits of varying sizes, and you know, you see our people in there on Saturday mornings. I don't know how they're paying compensation and all that, versus they do comp time or overtime or whatever. But it seems to me that they're not overpaid because we do a salary. We're in some pretty nice real estate that we got a bargain on. And then we looked at services that we could cut and didn't feel that there was really anything we could cut. Everything that gets purchased gets beat up seriously. Don't think we're in any of the famous $75 hammers or any of that kind of thing. So, you know, I for one am satisfied that we really reviewed everything, and I would urge you to ask any of the other members. In fact, I guess I did a little grandstanding a couple of times, and I just said, you know, everybody here is thinking they paying too much for everything, and I think we should be a little more open-minded about it. And I actually, you know, I said it in those words. So I would urge you to ask not only the lawyer members, but also thinking of my other fellow guy, Bill Granger, the banker who really had a sharp pencil. Probably he and I, had they had a number, I thought he was being too tough on the staff and the budget.
Representative Guerra?
Yeah, Mr. Fallhaber, I guess just two comments. I guess I have a conflict on one of them, so I'll declare it in a moment. But I have no doubt that you're probably right about the expenses you just went through. If you went through the budget sheets and you thought that it was efficiently run, that's good. But there are things that obviously strike out to me, like there's a newspaper that you get as a bar member. I've read it about four times in my life. I enjoyed it three of those four times, but I didn't want it. But I got it, and I assume that that's probably about $50 a year worth of my bar dues. And I guess I'm not comfortable sitting here that I could think that it's running as efficiently as possible. That's one comment. The other, and I'll just leave you with this, and whatever response you have is great. I don't practice anymore. And I'll give you a couple of the reasons. The only practice I was doing for a while was volunteer work I did over the Brother Francis Shelter. And I was told by the bar that if I wanted to do that, I had to pay $600 a year. So $600 a year that I had to pay for volunteering. And I know I came over to the Bar Association and I said, well, could you maybe have an exception for people who don't practice for money? And the answer was no. And then I went inactive, so now I pay $100 a year and the bar doesn't regulate me. So all of those concerns lead me to the conclusion that maybe it's not being run as efficiently as possible. Maybe you have a response to those things.
First, the bar reg. Probably about 4 or 5 years ago, I had the same opinion as you did. And we formed an ad hoc committee. Investigate the bar reg, their ad sales, their cost of production, everything. And
Why Rock rejected my request?
That committee, I think I chaired it, and Ethan Tinglin was on it. And I'm trying to think of the third person, but at any rate, we reviewed it and determined that it was run cheap. One of the purposes of the bar reg that's not an optional thing is all, we have to publish changes in bar rules and a number of other things. That has to be done. So as a way of reaching board or bar members, it's probably the cheapest way we can do it is just to publish it in the bar reg. Now that you raised the issue, possibly the electronically things could be published, and I'll make a note of that. But then we'll review that. Maybe we can change that. On the pro bono work, how current was your problem with that?
I think I did that through about 2002, so I think I probably approached them maybe in 2001. And the response was that you had to show that you were doing something like 40 hours a month of free work or some huge amount of, and frankly, all I was doing was about 5 hours a month or something like that. So I didn't meet the timer threshold.
And you're doing only pro bono?
Yeah.
I believe right now, if you wish to do that and you did it under or through Alaska Legal there's been I believe it's either free or the dues have been reduced considerably.
Mm. It did have an impact.
And I'm not certain of that, but if you want, I can check on that and get back to you.
Would you do that, Mr. Fallhaber? If you would get back to us here at the Judiciary Committee so we can distribute it to everybody, that would be great. The only other area, too, while you're at it, and just to put on the record, and hopefully you can be a leader in the area if you choose to or thought, one of the concerns that I have, too, when you come fresh out of law school, you're very poor, and you are, in most cases, going through a whole summer without revenue, and you then have to pay to take the bar exam. And one of the things that I was shocked when I made the decision to come home to Alaska was to see the high amount of money that was assessed just to take the bar in Alaska. And I compared it with some of my peers and students that were going to other places, and it was by far the highest. It was even higher than the New York bar exam, but only by a little bit. So New York and Alaska being the highest, and you know, thousands of people sit for the New York bar. So it's something that I hope you'll consider. And I understand that, you know, writing the test and administering it is costly, and but I also understand that a lot of volunteer work goes into it, to the extent that you can just keep that in mind and think about it. Once you're practicing, I do think the bar dues are too high. I've heard that from a number of my friends that practice. But I also think you need to consider at the outset those folks that are coming fresh out of law school, don't have a lot of money, and it might be a deterrent for them to sit for the bar here. And so I don't know what response you have now. But.
Well, I guess the question I would ask, you know, to go back to who should pay for the cost, the charges for the bar exam are cost-driven, so it's not a thing that we make money on. So the question is, would you be willing as a sitting attorney, as a member, to subsidize the bar exam for new lawyers or new wannabe lawyers? If the membership wanted that, I probably wouldn't have a problem with it. But in my heart of hearts, I think that anytime you can actually nail down the cost of a service and pass it on to the recipient, it's probably a way.
Yeah, well, just to follow up on that, I understand that there's that tension between, you know, the folks that are already sitting and paying exorbitant, in my opinion, fees, dues every year, and then to ask them to absorb would be tough. But, you know, Representative Guerra is right. It's fascinating. You know, this isn't obviously rocket science. There are bar associations in every single state. And somehow, even in small states like Wyoming, they find a way to make it work more efficiently. And I'm just simply saying, and maybe asking you too, to look into maybe how other states have reduced the cost of administering the bar exam itself. And I don't know the answer. I don't know, you know, what testing service you use. And maybe it's even not having it at the Egan Center. Maybe it's having it located in a space that's donated or that's at a lesser amount of money. That may be part of the overhead. Maybe it's reducing the bar to 2 days versus 2.5 days. Maybe it's focusing more on standardization versus, the heavy intensity on subjective essay questions. I don't know the answer, but I'm just simply saying that when you come straight out of law school and you're looking at $1,000 to sit for an exam for which you don't know whether you'll pass or not, to get a job, to pay back the money, it's an unbelievable expense. And if you don't have a family to turn to or a savings account, it's daunting. So just something to think about. I don't know who oversees that particular part of it, but I would encourage you to look at any efficiencies that could be there. And then just a final thought, maybe an external audit. You know, sometimes we're too close to things. It's very difficult for some of the government agencies to come in here and tell us as legislators what area of their budget they would cut. It's very difficult for them to tell us what could be done more efficiently. And yet, as the chairman of Legislative Budget and Audit can tell you, we do find them. We do find places where we can do things better. And perhaps having a neutral third party look at what you're doing and make recommendations might be a thought. So those are my thoughts. Representative Anderson and then Groenberg.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Thank you, Joe, for your comments, and appreciate your willingness to serve on the bar. Another thing I would add is, having taken the bar, if you don't pass and if you have to retake it again, the fee is
I think $500. And then if you opt not to take it again longer than the next test, meaning a year, they raise it back up to the original, I think it's the original fee again to take it. And I think that's just personally unfair, because folks who don't pass it and want to take it again 3 years later have to pay that full amount. And I think I know it doesn't cost that much, and I don't want to see a windfall or a profit from it. I'd like to see it cost exactly. And I think that the fingerprints and all those things that are held in the file don't go away after 1 year. The only thing is maybe the employment record or verification of where you work. And so maybe consider that if it reduces down to 500 on your second time, keep it at 500 no matter when you take it in the future. Thanks.
Representative Groomer.
Two things. First of all, on the point of the bar fees, and listening to what both the Chair, Representative McGuire, and Vice Chair, Representative Anderson, said, maybe one thing that could be done to help these young people take the bar is to allow them to pay it over time. Maybe allow them, because, you know, it's going to take them a little while to get their first paycheck after they're admitted. And if it's like $600 or something like $800, well, then
that's
they...
your Barbary class, which is about $1,600.
I can't deal
Madam
with that.
Madam Chair, let's distinguish taking the bar test versus the bar fees after admittance. I mean, there's
no, I'm talking about the test now.
Yeah.
That the test maybe, if it's $800...
Is it 800? It's close to 900, I believe. Do you know, Mr.?
Yeah, well, my recollection is it's 800.
It's closer to 900.
Okay, let's say it's 900. Maybe they could be given, if they paid a tiny bit of very minor interest, 2 years to do that, so they pay a little bit every 6 months. That would help a lot of young people, and I don't know, it's just a personal thought. I hadn't been aware. And, of course, we're in the legislature here. We don't micromanage any of these boards. That's just a thought.
I'm
not supposed to.
But I personally championed and passed the policy of accepting credit cards.
Yeah, that's helpful. But don't forget, and I'm talking because we had a young associate, these people all come out of law school, and I was just talking with another young graduate who happens to work around here. I won't mention their name. She stepped out of the room. they have large credit cards. Things too, and that interest will eat them alive.
Yeah.
And anyway, just a thought, sir.
Because you've been buying your books on your credit cards.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I won't tell you where I went and how it was cheap. Anyway, they got what they paid for.
You're lucky.
But the other thing on what Representative Garris said, I happen to like the bar rag. It's called the bar rag, and the motto is dignitas semper dignitas, dignity always dignity, and they call it the bar rag. Anyway, what you do with it's up to you, but there are some of us who like it and read it.
Representative Vaughn.
Oh, Madam Chair, I think before I get going here, Joseph, I just declare an interest being an active member of the bar, so some of my comments, you know, might have some conflict to them. I really don't mind the fee that they take for taking the exam. I paid mine, and I'm sure it was a long time ago. And I don't know what it is now. But as to the dues, last time I recall paying dues, which was this year, $450, $52, something like that, not $600. But it's very nice to know that Representative Guerra, if you do have that pro bono rule, that he can start practicing again. That would be very nice for him. But I would like to see the dues lowered if it's at all possible. For some of us in the outlying areas, not in the great municipalities, it is a little harder on some of us out there. One thing, and this is where my conflict probably comes in, and I don't know whether you, which way you look at this, but you do give CLE credit for people who are professors and teach law classes at the university. I was curious on the CLE credits for sitting legislators. Mm-hmm. Would that be a positive or a negative on your CLE credit? But I think there should be some countenance to that. Your comments on that?
Yeah, by credit, you mean you would get for your voluntary or mandatory CLE, but receive credit as if you had attended a class?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I and that's something I will propose that.
Madam Chair,
Representative Groomberg?
We obviously have a terrific conflict of interest, all of the lawyers in the who are active in this thing. But the lawyers and also the staff, actually, who happen to be lawyers, during the session, it's hard to take CLEs, but we do a lot of research, legal research. We all do, whether we're on the Judiciary Committee or not. It might be something to think of, at least a couple. It would help because we're out of pocket for at least 4 months of the year.
Mm-hmm. Well, that makes sense.
Follow up, Madam Chair. If it would be similar, the amount of hours put in here studying are far more than I generally put in when I was adjunct professor teaching law classes at the college there. And I think there was plenty of credit that I would get doing that. I think it should be somewhat comparable to that.
Well, and some of the most technical things that he's going to do. So if that makes sense to me, I will definitely bring that up.
And a follow-up, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate your comments, Joseph, and it appears to me you really, as a layperson, dug into this issue and really become an aficionado of our legal system, and I appreciate your wanting to put your time and effort in on this.
Yeah, we all do. Thank you very much, especially as a member of the public. Representative Guerra?
Yeah, members of the committee, I apologize, but this is actually something of great interest to me, and I know we're running out of time. Mr. Fallhaber, this is Les Guerra again, and I'm sorry I sounded a little bit cranky. We're all a little bit cranky around here getting at the end of the session, so I hope you don't take any of this personally. And the frustration has been with the bar, not with you. But I guess I'll just go one more area, because I really do believe that the bar has been non-responsive on matters. I mean, I think the volunteer issue I talked about, you know, I think they probably do have something, maybe if you affiliate yourself with Alaska Legal Services, but you should just be able to volunteer, I think. But the other issue, when the other members started talking about the bar exam, and frankly, I brought this one to the bar exam too, and I was very, very irritated with the response of the Bar Association. The hardest part of the test, many people feel, is the standardized part that everybody takes all across the country, the multi-state part of the exam. In Alaska, if you take that exam, you do very well somewhere else. You pay the $1,000 course just so you can pass it. When you come up here, the Bar Association tells you have to take that part all over again. And that's an expense that I think is completely needless. And it's an expense of money. It's an expense of the time that you have to put into studying for a test that bears virtually no relation to what you do as an attorney. And so I remember asking the Bar Association if they would consider waiving people in on that part of the exam if they took it already and got a good grade. And, you know, I put in, and the answer was no. And I guess... my frustration is on a few issues. I think the bar has taken the position that it's more important to resist change than to think about change. I don't know if you're even familiar enough with that subject, but I would really like the Bar Association to take another look at forcing people who've already done well on the multi-state to take it all over again when they come up here. I don't have a conflict on that. I mean, I just promised myself after I dealt with the bar exam that I would take that on as an issue, and I did and lost.
I wonder on a clearly on a state with reciprocity, you only the state portion, and there definitely has been discussion on whether to take this multi-state over again. And once again, at what date was that? I wonder if that's changed since you championed.
My challenge was probably I probably came to the Bar Association in 1998 or 2000 or so, and asked them to take a look at it, and they brought in a psychologist who said that would make the test statistically improper, but, you know, the psychologist also said that no other states do this, and then I did some research after the hearing and found out that other states did, in fact, do it, so that's all I can share, really.
Okay. Okay, so what I should check and get back to you is, one, the multi-state, take it over again if you pass it. Two, the cost of repeat takes on the exam, especially if there's a lapse of time, once it drops for a repeat guy or gal, it should stay down. Three, what's happening with pro bono now for mm-hmm. having to pay full dues. And then four, trying to get some CLE credits for those making our law.
Yeah, and then just to add, some efficiency or some reflection on the cost of administering the bar itself and whether or not a different venue could be used to reduce, you know, the overhead. I mean, the Egan Center, I think, is fairly expensive. Maybe there's a place, a person that would donate a space that would be secure with monitors and so on, proctors.
That has happened. I believe they used a church or
yeah.
place that was free sometime in the last year for one of the exams.
That would be great, but I didn't see the cost of taking the exam reduced. So, you know, something that could not just reflect a savings, but reflect it in the amount that's assessed to that person that's coming fresh out of law school. And then Representative Gruenberg brought up a point, just something to consider. Is there some kind of a plan? I don't know how feasible it would be, but that somebody who had a hardship or didn't have all of the money up front could be put on a payment plan. But just some reflection on that. I mean, I think overall the better thing is to see if there's a way to reduce it. You know, most folks are paying $400 to take the exam. That's reasonable. That's what you're seeing. Alaska is twice that amount. And I think that's unreasonable. So,
okay, do we have consensus, or do you have consensus around that table there, that you would like to have the cost of the bar exam lowered, even if, I mean, let's say assume that we do make it as efficient as possible, then, you know, if you finance it or if you lower it, conceivably going to cost existing members, is that an acceptable situation within reason?
I'll ask these around. I don't think so, though. My intent, anyway, and my comments, and I'll let them, I think they're shaking head no. That's not what we mean to say, because obviously they're two separate areas. What I'm saying is within the test-taking part itself, efficiencies, again, use of a church, use of a school, use of someplace, and then or reduction of days or consolidation of days, and then passing the savings on to the test takers. So, Representative Guerra?
Thanks. Mr. Fallhaber, certainly our comments are just really our personal comments, and we're actually hiring you to do the job, so we're just sharing some frustrations, and assuming you get reappointed, then just do your best job. There's no real directive, I don't think, here for us to tell you how to do the job. We just want you to do it as well as possible. But and for example, there were two members who said that maybe we should get credit for being in the legislature, CLE credit. I think that's something you guys should discuss. I would personally disagree with that. I think lawyers who practice 50 hours a week do a lot more legal research than we do, and they don't get credit for that. So. But those are all issues for you to decide. We're just asking you to be responsive to maybe looking at making the Bar Association a little more flexible and responsive.
Yeah, so I think the three things that I've heard that you could say there would be a, and someone can disagree as I summarize, would be that some method of assessing efficiencies within the test taking itself, and how to lower that amount as much as possible, with an eye toward the fact that most folks taking the exam are fresh out of law school and don't have a lot of money. And that includes leveraging volunteers, leveraging nonprofits, and folks in the community that can help to subsidize some of the costs and pass those on to the test taker. The second is the assessment of the bar dues themselves, which do seem high. A look at that, and again, I mentioned the idea of having even potentially an audit by a third party, because I think it's very difficult to self-assess sometimes. It's very difficult. And then the third thing that was brought up was the flexibility, and then just the ability to move with the times. If somebody comes forward with an idea or an opinion about something, we'd hope that the bar would be responsive and at least listen.
Okay, but those are points well taken. And I can pledge to you that guy right here, I will bring this stuff up.
Great. Okay. Is there a motion? Representative Anderson?
Yeah, sure. I guess I move the confirmation appointee Joseph Bauhaber out of committee and move his name to be forwarded to the full House, and note that our movement does not suggest opposition or support of his name, but only that we have considered his name and that the voting will be on the House floor.
Okay, is there any objection to that motion? Hearing none, Mr. Fellharber, your name has been forwarded on to the full body. Thank you for your time and your great service that you've provided for all of us.
Well, and I would like to thank all of you. It's a two-way thing, and I know you could probably all do better financially somewhere else. Thank you.
Thank you. That's true. All right. With that, we're going to go back to bloodborne pathogens, House Bill 309, and let's hear from Portia. Tell us about the medical director, and then it's my opinion that we ought to go ahead and deal with the bill today not hold it up further. But Ms. Parker?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Again, Portia Parker with the Department of Corrections. I'm kind of regained my composure here, so I can do a little better job, I hope, explaining some of these. Since I wasn't here for the opening remarks, I'm sorry, I was working on another piece of legislation and got here late. First, I'd like to say that basically this legislation doesn't change anything that we're already doing under OSHA right now. The Department of Corrections already has established and policies for relating to the protection from, documentation of, and response to occupational exposures, and they're essentially the same as we're operating under right now under OSHA. So really, this is codifying what we're already doing, and that's why we have a zero fiscal note. We don't have much difficulty. Every once in a while we do. Most prisoners are very good. They actually volunteer to give a blood sample, or they notify us that they have some kind of a condition. When we can't, we get a court order, and usually it's fairly quick. The courts are responsive, and then we draw the blood. It's not a huge problem, but every once in a while it takes longer, and I know that in this specific situation, which prompted this legislation, an officer felt that it wasn't addressed quickly enough and he wasn't taken care of, and I understand that concern that he has. As I was not able to locate our medical director, he is doing work in Arizona at our contract facility right now, and I haven't been able to locate him, and I apologize for that. He is the expert on this, and we'll be able to answer all of those questions. But he did, in his analysis, what he told us is that everything that is outlined in this bill, we're already doing.
Representative, please continue.
In regard to some of these questions that have been raised by Health and Social Services, the first one about evidence, I think we've discussed that and why we would prefer that not be changed. In the test, as far as testing and looking at results that exist, we don't store the blood that's been drawn previously, but we do have a record of the results. And so the Department of Corrections, we don't really have a preference on that, whether it's a new blood sample or whether the only reason we would like to look at existing results is because it may be faster to find out when someone does have some kind of a bloodborne pathogen. If you go and look at a result and they had hepatitis or AIDS 3 months ago, they probably still have it. Now, it's not going to tell you what they have right now. Even a test right now may not tell you what they have right now. So not everything is going to be guaranteed, even if you immediately draw blood, because some people will have something that will not show up in that test yet, but it may 2 months from now. So there's nothing is guaranteed. What we do is try to provide the best protection we can. Now, if there was a result where nothing was shown 6 months ago or a year ago, the officer can still request, I want blood drawn now. I've had an exposure. My physician thinks it's necessary to draw. This blood sample is too old. The results are too old. I want to have a new blood sample to make sure I have not had an exposure. And we feel that that's covered. If there are concerns, then we can address that. But that's basically what we're doing right now in practice without this statute.
Could I on that point?
Representative Greenberg on that point?
Yeah. The thing that I am concerned about, Ms. Parker, is that the language on page 2, lines 24 to 26, seems to prohibit the Department of Corrections from trying to get existing test results before taking a new sample. And I don't want you to be impeded from taking a new sample. I don't have any problem with your doing it, but this limits your ability to get an immediate sample. And that's why I think that we ought to take that sample.
Chairman, Representative Greenberg, we don't necessarily have an opinion one way or the other on that one. If it's the will of the committee or the sponsor to first look at existing test results or immediately, automatically take a new one, we just don't, either way is fine.
I just don't want to, I want to give you the discretion. I'll do that at the appropriate time, I think. At least I'll ask Kurt what he thinks.
Anything else, Ms. Beck? I was just going to address one of the other issues that Representative Greenberg raised. It's listed as a 5 here on the bill analysis by Health and Social Services. I don't think that there is anything that we can do about that. I believe, and I will get this answer definitively, but I believe that we cannot release that information unless the person... We cannot release an officer's medical records without their consent. Unless the other party gets a court order to release that information, we can't. We can't even release medical information on offenders or inmates. It's very restrictive on what we can do with any test results or medical information disclosed to anyone, even people who are employed in the facility. So I think there are strict restrictions there that are in federal law that we simply have to abide by.
Madam Chair. I was looking at this late in the evening, and I obviously looked at the wrong, I think I looked at the wrong line there, but both subsection B on page 5, lines 9 to 11, and C, lines 12 to 16. Many of these prisoners are very litigious and will look at anything possible to goof up the system by bringing all kinds of lawsuits since they have a lot of time on their hands. I'm not a great fan of tort reform generally. But this seems to invite some lawsuits, and I'm not sub C. I guess maybe I didn't understand what they were. So I was looking at sub B, where you invite the prisoner to bring a lawsuit, almost. It looks to me like we might want to tighten that down if somebody is bringing a lawsuit for good cause, but I don't know. Maybe I'm speaking too soon.
Do you want a comment from Senator Wagner's office about why that was included in the bill? I didn't know the reasoning.
Because it says releases. Maybe you want to put knowingly or recklessly or something, because you could have just an inadvertent.
Well, with malice, yeah.
For the record, my name is Kurt Olson, staff to Senator Tom Wagner again. I believe the wording has been tested in other states, particularly Wisconsin, partially modeled after that. And,
what about the federal?
I feel like we had to reinvent the wheel on
what about the federal language? Does it have a civil action language in it? Do you remember?
I don't know off the top of my head. I'm sorry.
Okay.
What they're talking about, Madam Chair, I'm sort of interrupting.
Yeah, at a minimum, a mental intent.
If you take a look on line 15 and 16, there the standard is a good faith effort to comply with the statutes. And they don't have the standard of a good faith effort on line 6. I'm sorry, not line 6. I'm talking about lines 9 to 11. The standard isn't a good faith effort to comply with the statute. Because here, don't forget what we're doing here is they may provide information. They'd probably be providing information to somebody to save their life, you know. You want to make sure that they protect these people who are bitten.
We'll look at amendments to that. Okay, Representative Ogg.
Madam Chair, I think it's fairly well crafted. How it's been put together, and I was missing that one part on the criminal proceeding. But I did have a question here, and mostly for my own information. And I noticed on the federal one, they just make a requirement that anybody who is convicted of an offense is sentenced for a period of 6 months or more, they are to be tested. And are we able to do that? Do we do that? Because it would seem like you unknowingly, if you don't test, may be placing somebody who has one of these types of diseases into a confined population and causing a spread of infection within that population. It would seem for a health and safety measure that we should be testing. Do you have comments on that?
Madam Chairman, is the question, are we testing every prisoner who's convicted, trying to find out if they have bloodborne pathogens? I do not believe we are, but I would have to check with Dr. Robertson to make sure. One reason is it's very expensive to do that. Now, I know that we do test if there's any indication or if there's any medical reason to do so, but I don't feel comfortable answering that definitively, whether we do that or not.
Okay. Representative Ogg?
My thought is that because we're going to this thing where we can require people to be tested by statute, because it's going to save a lot of money on the people who actually guard and take care of these folks, that if you had foreknowledge when people came into the system, that you certainly would save a lot of money. Because you'd know who problem cases were, and you could isolate that somehow.
Okay, all right. Anybody else here that I've overlooked that wants to testify in the audience? Anyone else online? Okay, so public testimony is closed. That brings the bill back before us. Let's mark it up and get it out and get on to our next bills, if that's okay. 3:30. Representative Gruenberg, amendment number one.
Yeah, I just have those. Most of these things are just questions that really aren't answered. The only thing I'd like to offer as an amendment, I think, is on page 2, lines 24 to 26, which requires the department to first attempt to get existing test results before taking any steps to obtain a blood sample or to test for pathogens. And this is what they talked about on page 2 of the letter, page 2, line 25. And I'd ask if Mr. Olson has any problem if that sentence were to come out.
Through the chair, I'd defer to Senator Wagner. I think just walked in, but I certainly wouldn't have any problem with it. But again, I'd like your corrections as to say on it.
And just to give the department discretion to move quickly.
Mm-hmm. So, Senator Wagner, we're looking at page 2, lines 24 through 26, and we're just contemplating removing that burden of first attempting to get existing test results. I think it's a good point. I mean,
I think it's a good point, Madam Chairman. The only thing I might say, it would depend on the currency of the tests they're looking at. If they have a very current sample there, then I would think maybe they would want to use that current sample. But if it's an old sample, I think they've already expressed the fact that they don't want to use an old sample anyway.
So it just gives them the discretion to do it or not.
Yeah.
So removing it doesn't say that they won't do that, but it just simply doesn't require them to jump through loopholes. It also doesn't even specify what test results. So, I mean, it could even be having to go to their doctor or something else where they might have given a blood sample for purposes of, I don't know, cholesterol testing or something. Okay, so that's amendment number one is page 2, lines 24 through 26 to delete the sentence, the department must first attempt to get existing test results, da 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 da. Do you want to move that? So moved. Is there any objection? No objection. Amendment number one carries. Representative Gruenberg, further amendment?
I don't think so. Was there anything else that was talked about?
We talked about the civil action on page 5 and a minimum kind of a mental intent.
I'll offer something on that.
Okay, Representative Gruenberg.
And again, I wanted the senator to know that I'm not going to offer something to you. That is here on page 5, and it's going to be a conceptual amendment. It says a person may bring a civil action against a person who releases the name or releasing information with the test results. And I want to say, if there is no good faith effort made to comply with AS 18.15.400-450.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On after who, and I'd leave it up to the drafters, and I think I'm going the same place, Representative Gruenberg, but something like a knowingly and with malice. And I don't know the term of art there, but you don't want somebody who just happens to say the name, and next thing you know, he's got a lawsuit against him. You know, that, and I think that's the point.
I don't want to have the requirement be with malice, but I knowingly or because this seems to imply an absolute. It doesn't even have to require a negligence standard.
Strictly. Representative Guerra?
We just have to come up with a standard here and not leave it for the drafter. I would say knowingly would make sense so you don't get somebody for an accident, but I think we have to come up with something very definite so it doesn't come back and forth.
What do we say? Knowing violation of? Instead of saying except as provided and say, in knowing violation of.
Knowingly violate.
Yeah, thanks, knowingly. Who knowingly violates.
Yeah.
That's conceptual.
Yeah, and let them do the grammar.
Madam Chairman, but if we go back to the statute that's discussed there, what does that statute say? I haven't looked that up.
That's the whole act.
First, back to the bill.
It's the whole bill. Yeah.
That comes back to the whole bill.
Yeah.
We're saying if somebody knowingly violates the bill.
Fine with me.
That's the right answer.
It's got to go back for concurrence anyway. Might as well.
No, I think we're just kind of wordsmithing around on something. It's acceptable either way to me, Madam Chairman.
Actually, hang on a second. I think what this section is doing is the opposite of what we thought. I think what it's doing is saying that you can't bring a civil action for something under this act. I think what it's saying is that you can bring a civil action against a person who releases the name and so on, except...
Well, Madam Chair?
Yeah.
The act itself says people can only, you know, we're talking about the privacy thing.
Right.
And it says who you can release the information to. And what I want to prevent is a correctional official getting sued because somebody technically violates this in a non-knowing way.
Yeah. I think that does get it, sir. Okay. So we'll leave it conceptual for the drafter, but the mental intent of knowingly violates it and as tight as you can make it so that the person instantly releases it, isn't punished. Are there any further amendments to Senate Bill 309?
Did we adopt that?
Oh. Is there objection to Amendment Number 2? I didn't ask. Okay, hearing none, Amendment Number 2 carries. The further amendments? Okay, hearing none.
I just have a moment just to triple check it. I don't think it's... Oh, yeah. I don't know if this was covered. I was concerned on page 2, lines 12 to 13. It says that you can't, and this deals, this, Ms. Parker said what this, all this means is that you can't use the evidence that they have collected. And I was persuaded by what you said, and I'm just wondering if there would be any circumstance where you, for some reason, would have to use the blood sample. And I'm going to give you an example. It just comes to mind. If, let us say, you have a horrible fire in a correctional institution, people are burned, and you don't have any other sample of their DNA or something like that, you might have to use it for identification or something. Would that ever occur that this might be the only sample you would have? Or somebody's escaped or something? I mean, I don't know. Not being able to think of the range of human experience like you guys.
Senator Wagner?
Madam Chairman, I would think in extenuating circumstances like that, that would be the time to go to court order if you wanted to use that.
Does this, through the chair, does this prevent you from getting a court order for that? Maybe in an escape situation.
Representative Samuels?
Even for the identification purpose, that wouldn't be a criminal or civil proceeding, though. It's getting... I was sold by the argument. First, I thought we should eliminate it.
Yeah.
But Ms. Parker sold me on her argument.
It's conceivable. I don't know. I just want to be sure... When we say something can't be used in any evidence,
sure.
Whether there might be any circumstance you need to use it, that's...
Do you have any heartburn with deleting the language?
Madam Chairman, the department certainly doesn't. The problem is that we have been warned that it will cause undue challenges and litigation if it's used in criminal or civil proceedings. That's been the experience in other jurisdictions. And this is really for the protection of the inmates, so.
Madam Chair, I know that's true. And I'm looking at it from the prosecution's point of view here. It doesn't make that much difference. I just want to be careful that we're not in some manner causing you some harm.
Well, I see what Representative Grunberg's saying, which is that fine enough if you want to eliminate the ability, let's say a guard was severely hurt, bit something like this, maybe your finger was bit off, and you criminal charges were going to be brought. And the prosecution wanted to be able to create a link that this testing was done and it was this person's blood and so on. I don't know. What he's saying is fine if you don't want to use the blood sample taken there, but we don't want this language to in any way prohibit as an absolute the prosecution's ability to ultimately use the blood sample in a way that they might need to. Representative Guerra?
I was comforted that it was absolutely clear in the bill that you could do that, that that the exception is that if this is related to a crime that you're going to prosecute, then it is admissible. And I mean, I just don't see the concern that that they wouldn't be able to use the blood.
And this is a legal, kind of a legal question here. If somebody sued the department saying, I was not tested, and because I wasn't tested, I wasn't treated, and because I wasn't treated, I wasn't cured, and I therefore developed this disease or whatever they had, it might be important to be able to establish the fact of testing to prove that you had tested and therefore the testing, the results had come back negative, so there was no need to treat.
All right, Senator Wagner?
I don't want to disagree with you, but I think we're getting way away from the purpose of the bill, which is really nothing to do with somebody who maybe wanted to be tested, wasn't tested, et cetera. I think we're getting way away from the point of the bill there. And I'm not an attorney, so I can't debate it with you, but there's been a lot of work go into this, and I think we're pretty on pretty firm ground.
Representative Samuels?
I've moved the bill with, as amended, with individual recommendations and
zero fiscal note. Any objection to that? Hearing none, Senate Bill 309 is moved. Thank you, Senator Wagner. Thank you, Ms. Gebhardt. Thank you, Mr. Olson.
Appreciate your time and effort. Thank you.
Welcome.
Very much.
Thank you very much. Okay, next we're going to take up House Bill 551. Yeah. And Representative Guerra was on the committee that heard it before, and we promised we were going to look at it. So we are. So why don't we just. Ryan is here to talk to us about it briefly, but let's move quickly because I think what we're going to do is we're just going to amend it to say only in the first degree. So we're going to eliminate second through fourth. Is that fair, Representative Guerra?
Sure.
Does that kind of get at what we talked about?
I think that would be the easiest thing to do. I was going to try and keep in some of those second and third and fourth degree ones by defining them, like the school zone ones.
You could do that conceptually.
Go ahead and try it. Just let me know, and I'll explain what my amendment would have done.
Bring it in and I'll
look at it. Ryan, I would just go quickly.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. For the record, my name is Ryan McKinstrom, aide to Representative McGuire. It's come to our attention, some of you may know from some recent news articles, that there have been a few teachers that have been convicted of drug convictions. And we understand, the sponsor understands, that in some cases people have made mistakes when they're younger that, you know, shouldn't prohibit them from pursuing, you know, possibly their life's goal of being a teacher. And we don't want to punish great teachers for a mistake they may have made when they're younger. So this issue is not directly related to drug use in general or private use. It's more specifically addressing felony drug convictions. And after the last committee and on recommendation of Representative Guerra, it looks like we want to tighten it up to specifically address first-class felony drug convictions, which for the most part is a criminal enterprise level or of manufacturing or intent to distribute. It doesn't address the issue of personal use or private possession. In actuality, I think Representative Guerra has a right idea of amending in bringing in some of the second and third class, because there's specific language in those in a statute that addresses drug offenses in regards to school zones and minors, which I think possibly is something we should address in this bill, because we're trying to the intent of the bill is to protect protect minors and people and our children in the educational system.
Thanks, Ryan. Yeah, this is a good amendment, Les. I like it. It's better.
Madam Chair, let me explain things to folks.
Okay, Representative Garrett, then Samuels.
Sorry, I wasn't looking. It's hard to do it perfectly. I mean, ideally what we want to do is get at people who are selling drugs, people who are manufacturing or possessing with the intent to sell drugs, and the school zone things also. The problem is the way that, so we can clearly get we can clearly do first degree. We can clearly do the school zone things because those statutory provisions are very identifiable. Where my proposed amendment gets a little vague is I also add any of the second through fourth degree ones that involve possession or manufacturing with the intent to distribute, except distribute could be sharing with the person next to you. Distribute isn't defined as sales. And so we could be a little overbroad and say manufacture or possess with the intent to distribute, but we would arguably possibly be getting into people who are sharing in a room with a bunch of friends when they're 19 years old, because that is distribute under the statute. So then I thought about saying distribute with the intent to sell, but the truth is, the way the criminal process works, when you get convicted of a crime, let's say you get convicted of second or third degree crime, the records will show you were convicted under that statute. It's going to be very hard to figure out what the conduct was that you were convicted of. We won't know whether you were trying to sell or not sell. And so there's really no perfect answer to trying to answer those questions for those people who do second or third or fourth degree crimes, whether they were trying to make money off of it or not. And so we could be underbroad and just be safe and do first degree and then the school zone violations and the school bus violations. Or we could try and figure out a way to do this thing about the second and third and fourth degree manufacturer and distributions, but we'll never know whether those were sharing distributions or sales distributions. And, I don't really know what to do about those. My sense is leave them out, we flag it for the school district, and the school district doesn't hire them anyway, but maybe they do. So I don't know. I don't have the perfect answer.
Representative Samuels?
I think, Madam Chair, I had a question, and I don't know who it's for, but for current law, you're talking about past convictions here before they become a teacher.
Representative Samuels, through the chair, actually, their certificate could be revoked if they're charged currently under this